Hello, everybody. With an election coming up in the UK after what has been a turbulent year for UK politics, we're going to be looking forward to a period of clarity and cleansing, after which, no doubt, everything will be plain sailing. And to discuss that with us is Sam Toombs, Chief UK Economist of Pantheon Macroeconomics.
You need a big majority to make some of those key decisions to get them through. And in particular, if there is a blocking number of sort of Eurosceptic MPs within the Conservative Party, say around 30, that, you know, were a real problem for Theresa May earlier this year, if they are ardently opposed to any further extension of the implementation period beyond December 2020, then we could be looking at another kind of cliff edge point for the economy in the second half of next year. And all that sort of Brexit uncertainty and delaying in investment as well would, you know, come back to the fore again.
Stay tuned after the following messages to hear from Sam.
The value of investments can fall and you may get back less than you invested. Past performance is not a reliable guide to future performance. The podcast is not intended as investment advice. No investment is suitable in all cases. Any tax allowances or thresholds mentioned are based on personal circumstances and current legislation, which may change. We or a connected party may have an interest in the securities mentioned or may act as principal or agent in those securities from time to time. The podcast content comes from diverse sources whose accuracy cannot be assured. The opinions expressed in this publication are not necessarily held throughout Brewin Dolphin. Investment in currencies other than your own means changes in the exchange rate will cause the value of your investment to move independently of the underlying asset.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another Brewin podcast with a huge choice in front of UK voters about their future. We are here and we're able to speak to Sam Toombs, who is the chief UK economist at Pantheon Macroeconomics, about what implications that choice might have for the future of the UK economy. So, Sam, I know you've been on the Brewin podcast several times before. Thanks very much for joining us and welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
We can't really talk too much about the UK economy without thinking about this election that is coming up. So just, you know, high level summary terms, what are you expecting from the election?
Well, right now the opinion polls are giving a pretty clear steer. They show the Conservatives are a long way ahead of Labour, yeah, around 12 percentage points on average. So if that happens, if that vote shares, you know, are translated into votes on at the ballot box the election, then we're looking at a Conservative majority of around 50 seats. But I think there are a couple of reasons to think that the Conservatives' poll lead might start to narrow over the next few weeks of the campaign. Actually, if you look back to past elections, it's only in the last two or three weeks that you do tend to see those big shifts in public opinion. So yeah, the first couple of weeks, people just switch off, and that it's only when the polls, the election day really comes around that you start to see big shifts in public opinion. So it's not too late yet to see a big shift in public opinion. At the moment in the opinion polls, you do see quite a large chunk of people still saying that they don't know. It's around 15 to 20% in most opinion polls, and those people are stripped out of the voting intentions summaries. There's no sort of reallocation of those votes at all. And if you look at how those people voted in the 2017 general election, then they disproportionately voted Labour or for the Liberal Democrats. I think that suggests that when they do finally make up their mind again in the final week or two of the election campaign, they're more likely to come back to either Labour or the Liberal Democrats and lead to a narrowing of the Conservatives' opinion poll lead. I think also if you just stand back at the moment and look at consumer sentiment, most indicators of consumer confidence are just merely in line with their long run average and sort of below the levels that you usually see when an incumbent government is re-elected. The GfK Consumer Confidence Index, for instance, is below the levels we saw in 2017 when, of course, the Conservatives failed to get an outright majority. So I think that just points to being a bit cautious as well with these opinion polls. And again, as public considers wider issues, not just Brexit, but the state of the economy and the NHS in particular, we might start to see the Conservatives' lead narrow a little.
So that's a really interesting point. So what the implication of that is that a government would normally call an election at a time when the economy is at least a bit more buoyant than it is right at the moment.
That's right, or if they waited to the end of a 4 or 5 year parliamentary cycle, that, you know, they've had a couple of years to prime the economy with a few tax cuts or expenditure giveaways. So, you know, that we haven't had that bit long build up to an election, and therefore, you know, the economy is not in the greatest state. Of course, if you look at unemployment, you know, that's one indicator that's very good at the moment. Extremely low levels of unemployment, but, you know, wage growth is only just exceeding inflation. People, we see rising concerns about job security and concerns about the outlook for Brexit as well. So if you look at the GfK Consumer Confidence Survey, which is the best sort of long-term indicator of household sentiment that we've got, the current levels of sentiment are actually lower than they were before all of the last 8 general elections.
Right, okay, fine. So even though unemployment is quite low and wages have been at least rising, it's just not as strong an economy as you would typically have before going to the polls. And so in terms of if we were to get a Conservative victory, what do you think the implications of that, how would that change this sort of economic status quo that we've got at the moment?
Well, I think the real issue is over the size of the Conservative majority that we see. I said at the moment, with a 12 percentage point lead in the polls, the Conservatives look like they're heading for a majority of around 50 seats approximately. I think that would be enough for Boris Johnson then to go into the second phase of Brexit talks with a lot of flexibility. He's not going to be controlled by any particular wing of his party. If he needs to force through an extension beyond the first year of negotiations and in order to allow more time for a comprehensive free trade agreement to negotiate it, then I think he'll be able to do so with such a large amount of leverage. If, on the other hand, the polls start to narrow and we see, say, only a very small Conservative majority or perhaps even another minority Conservative government, then Boris Johnson really is in a very difficult position going into that second phase of Brexit talks. You know, I still think there would be a majority to get the existing withdrawal agreement through by the end of January, but it's then where we enter the phase of trade talks where we could really start to see issues come to the fore, and you need a big majority to make some of those key decisions and to get them through. And in particular, if there is a blocking number of sort of Eurosceptic MPs within the Conservative Party, say around 30, that, you know, were a real problem for Theresa May earlier this year, if they are ardently opposed to any further extension of the implementation period beyond December 2020, then we could be looking at another kind of cliff edge point for the economy in the second half of next year. And all that sort of Brexit uncertainty and delaying in investment as well would come back to the fore again.
So that's the withdrawal agreement would have been passed under those circumstances, but then you would be approaching December 2020 with the real prospect of trading on WTO terms.
That's the scenario that worries me with a small Conservative majority. If we're talking about, say, just 20 to 30 seats, then the European Research Group MPs that really kicked up a fuss and tried to steer the economy potentially towards a no-deal Brexit at the end of March earlier this year, and they would have a lot of leverage again. And currently you need Parliament to agree to any further extension of the implementation period or the transition period beyond December 2020. And we're going to need an extension to actually thrash out the details of a new trade deal with the EU.
So that's very clear and coherent. I'm fascinated to hear what you think would happen in the minority government scenario, or the scenario in which the Conservatives don't win enough votes to form a majority government.
Well, then it depends upon who their coalition partners might be. The Brexit Party might win a couple of seats, in which case, you know, then there are question marks, I think, over whether the withdrawal agreement that we have on the table that needs to be ratified by the end of January could actually get through. Again, Boris Johnson would need Labour votes. That might open up the possibility of the bill then being amended in various ways and then further protracted uncertainty. In that scenario, no deal Brexit risk comes back to the fore, sterling takes a hit again. So certainly the worst outcome, I think, for markets would be another Conservative minority government. We could see sterling back down to the low 120s against the US dollar.
Okay, and so a Conservative minority government, meaning that they're the largest party, therefore they get the chance to try and form a government, and they can find, out of a reduced number of potential friends, they can find enough to get to a majority, and that, as you say, could be one or two Brexit Party seats, but unlikely to be anything more than that.
Yes, and then the DUP as well will pick up 8 to 10 seats probably again. So there's also possibility for another confidence of supply arrangement with them. But of course, you know, they were opposed to the existing withdrawal agreements. It's not clear, therefore, that the bill would actually get through in January. So if there is this Conservative minority government, markets will immediately then start to price in again the possibility of a no-deal Brexit at the end of January, in which case sterling and UK equity prices, you know, are hit by that.
Okay. And then I guess the other scenario is that they have such a small vote share that they or seat share that they can't get to any kind of workable government, and then the impetus switches.
So the impetus would switch, and the most natural government then would be a Labour led government. And the Liberal Democrats seem very cagey about entering into any sort of formal coalition with the Labour Party, and it may be that as a price for any support, they would try and remove Jeremy Corbyn as leader of Labour. But of course, you've got the SNP as well into the equation there. They're likely to pick up, 40 to 50 seats, probably more than the Liberal Democrats. So they may well have more leverage than them. That could be a very, messy political agreement. It's unlikely, I think, that you'd see a sort of strong coalition that would last the 5-year parliamentary term being formed between Labour and those other parties. But there would be some upsides for markets in the scenario. We could then be pretty confident that a no-deal Brexit isn't going to happen, and the possibility of a Remain seriously comes back on the table, given that those parties are committed to at least having a referendum where Remain is a serious option on the table. Given that sterling still is well below the sort of pre-referendum levels of 145 against the US dollar at the moment, just hovering around 130 at this stage, there's still an awful lot of sort of Brexit damage priced into the exchange rate. And were Remain to come back on the table and eventually that to actually be implemented and Brexit to go away, then I think that would offset a lot of markets' concerns about the wider policies of a Labour-led government.
And a Labour-led government, so picking up on exactly that point, a Labour-led government supported by the SNP, not reliant upon the Liberal Democrats, would that government pursue the many eye-catching policies of the Labour Party, which I think would cause some anxiety amongst investors?
Well, the thing is that Jeremy Corbyn doesn't speak entirely for the Labour Party. There's diverse range of views within the Labour Party. He would have to build internal coalitions within the Labour Party to get any of his policies through as well. Even in this scenario, which you had a very unlikely scenario at this stage of a Labour majority government, he still wouldn't be wielding all the power. He'd have to build up support from more centrist MPs.
So if Labour were to win an outright majority, you'd think there'd still be some doubt over whether it would pursue the 4-day week or nationalisation of the utilities and things like that. You still think that wouldn't be a fait accompli?
I think that's right. There are still it would depend upon the size of their majority, but just as Boris Johnson would struggle on Brexit with a very small Conservative majority, then so too I think with Corbyn, with his quite radical socialist agenda, he would struggle to get all of it through Parliament. And certainly if he's dependent upon the Liberal Democrats, then I think they would act as quite an anchor on really what he can achieve.
Okay, well, I'm sure that leaves us all really looking forward to this cleansing and revelatory election that we're going to have. I mean, obviously there's been loads of emphasis on the fiscal policies of the respective parties. Can we even trust these ambitions? That say to return to the core scenario. Is it likely that a Conservative government would follow through on the pledges that it seems to be making at the moment?
So the Conservatives' new fiscal rules appear to commit them to targeting a current budget balance over a 3-year rolling period. The current budget is broadly in balance right now, so any extra tax cuts that we see in this election are going to have to be offset with other tax increases that they may not talk about in their manifesto, or further spending cuts. Overall, the package has to be sort of fiscally neutral at the moment in order to meet that target.
Right.
But they have pledged to increase government investment up to 3% of GDP. At the moment, it's hovering around 2% of GDP. So there's scope for some fiscal boost to come through to the economy under the Conservatives.
And the point is that it's in the form of investment rather than spending, and that's how it ends up being balanced, is it?
That's right. So the Conservatives have to run a balanced current budget. So the day-to-day expenditure has to equal the amount of revenue coming in the door. But they will borrow in order to invest, and that borrowing can go up to 3% of GDP. So there is, given that investment is only 2% of GDP right now by the government, there's scope for a fiscal boost to filter through in the next few years. I think also importantly, this is a rolling target to meeting the current budget. They don't have to hit it year after year. They just have to be on course to get there in 3 years' time, which does open up some wiggle room and perhaps does open up a little bit of scope for some tax cuts in their manifesto, which is just about to be published.
Okay. And obviously one of the things they've done relatively early is rowing back on a previous pledge to continue cutting corporation tax. Is that going to free up some fiscal space for other giveaways or something?
Well, yes, it does seem like that was designed to allocate more money to government departments, particularly the NHS, which is going to face a lot of demographic pressure over the next few years. That was a pretty clear indication, I think, that the Conservatives are focusing what limited firepower they do have to cut taxes on, relatively low-paid workers. And so we've had some news over the last 24 hours that they're going to increase the point at which you have to start paying national insurance contributions. That's a measure that is going to certainly help low-income earners. And therefore, that's a sign of, I think, where they're trying to focus their fiscal firepower right now.
And that seems like quite a sensible policy, because with national insurance, tax rates seem to go up really quite sharply at quite low levels of income. Is that?
Yes, national insurance, though, is paid by everyone. There are better ways of targeting fiscal support to the sort of low-income earners, if that's really what you want to do. This is something that will benefit pretty much all earners.
Yeah.
And therefore, it's perhaps just a general measure to boost sentiments and try and improve their chances of winning the election.
And in terms of the spending that's being allocated to departments, obviously most notably the NHS, I mean, that there are some concerns that the NHS doesn't really have the opportunities to deploy that spending, and therefore it's all going to go effectively on higher wages, which I'm sure to many people will seem entirely fair enough. But that doesn't mean an increase in productivity for government departments. Does that seem realistic?
There's certainly a danger that the overall with the government that it is going to be trying to hit some arbitrary targets for increases in capital expenditure, and some of these measures won't be as well thought out as others. There's always a concern about what projects really are shovel ready within the Treasury and which are going to pay good returns. But at the moment, the public sector infrastructure projects, you don't need to pay a very good return, given that public borrowing costs are so low right now. This is perhaps a once in a generation opportunity to capture very low borrowing issuance costs for the government, and therefore particularly as well, given that government investment has been relatively constrained over the last 5 or 6 years relative to the past, I think there's probably still are some many infrastructure projects that could pay back a handsome return for the economy as a whole, and also for the public sector.
So I mean, in that context, is the government's ambition surprisingly restrained? The Prime Minister in particular is renowned for quite liking big infrastructure projects. Do you think they could be targeting more?
Well, at 3% of GDP, government investment would return to the levels we saw in the late 1970s. So this is quite a big increase.
It's big.
Above the levels of investment that we saw in the Blair years, for instance. The Labour's policies suggest that they'd be taking investment all the way up to 4% of GDP, which would be the sort of early 1970s level. So this is a pretty big shift, particularly as well, given that back in the 1970s, there were a lot of nationalised industries, and so the government was investing in things that now businesses invest in. So this really is we are starting to see a step change in government capital expenditure. Maybe they will struggle to get investment up to those sorts of levels immediately, but by the end of a five-year parliament, I think that should be achievable.
So you mentioned earlier a possibility of tax cuts. I guess that there's things like the British Social Attitudes study seem to suggest that generally there's much more appetite for improvements in public services and even a willingness to pay more taxes, rather surprisingly. So do you think tax cuts are going to fall, the traditional kind of giveaway of the Conservative Party, do you think they're going to form part of this this proposition?
Well, I think the Conservatives probably will be the only party offering some tax cuts, which benefit the majority of people going into this election. You know, the Liberal Democrats' main policy on taxation is to increase the basic rate of income tax by 1p to allocate more funding to the NHS. We don't know exactly what Labour's policies are going to be yet, but there still will be an emphasis within the Conservatives' manifesto on trying to keep taxes low. But clearly, it seems likely that Boris Johnson's pledge within the Conservative Party leadership campaign to increase the levels at which you start to pay the higher rate of income tax, those promises are not going to be in the Conservatives' manifesto. And I think that does accept a brutal reality that going forwards, just the demographic pressures on the public finances are going to be so strong that we need to keep tax levels at least where they are.
And with the amount of public spending that's taking place and potentially the amount that ends up going into salaries, with the potential restriction on immigrant labour, is this a big inflationary threat? Do you think is this a big factor in your inflationary forecasts?
It's a threat that needs to be considered, but we at the moment there are so many missing pieces of information to really produce, have any confidence in a forecast that inflation might be, picking up to 3 or 4% in a couple of years' time.
Right.
In particular, what matters really is the government's immigration policies as well. Certainly, if you're looking at the NHS,
yeah,
and whether there's perhaps an opt out or some exclusion of NHS employment from the sort of overall immigration statistics, there's still a lot of ambiguity over what a Conservative government's immigration policy would be. Until we get some sort of real flesh on the bones there, it's quite hard to say whether there's going to be sort of labour shortages emerging that could push up wage growth. But I mean, certainly at the moment we have an unemployment rate that is the lowest we've seen since the mid-1970s. When you hear about the government saying, we're going to recruit X thousand police officers or NHS workers, where are they going to come from? There is a real need for relatively high levels of immigration going forwards over the next 5 years, given how many people currently in the UK are set to retire, and the fact that the government is trying to scale up its public service provision in so many different areas right now, really to make the whole thing work and for that inflation pressure not to come through, we do need to see a continuation of relatively high levels of immigration.
Okay, so that's the Labour side of things. And then just in terms of the future trading relationship then, what are the different models of trading relationship that we could have? I think we've already said we could be on WTO terms in the event of a narrow Eurosceptic marginal Tory majority. But in the sort of 50 to 60 seat majority, what relationship would you expect?
Well, on paper, the Conservatives are aiming for a free trade agreement where tariffs are, there are no tariffs at all on trade between the UK and the EU, but there would still be customs checks as part of any deal. Regulatory alignments is another key issue under the Conservatives' sort of scenario. And they would want the UK to no longer be following EU rules closely, but that does therefore lead to further frictions in trade, further need for checks. And UK firms would be imposed with potentially two sets of costs in trading in the UK market and then in the EU market following different rules and regulations. So there's, in the Conservatives' big picture a vision for Brexit, we're heading for a free trade agreement, which is relatively simple, that enables us to do trade deals with other countries as well. But this is something which businesses will have to take the burden of some of the costs there. And it's possible that as the negotiations commence, that the Conservatives start to reconsider how much of a hard separation they want from the EU and whether actually some form of rule taking is optimal for the economy. The amount of lobbying we're going to see from all kinds of businesses during the phase of trade talks, both on the EU side and on the UK side, is just going to go through the roof. This is going to be a very torturous process, and I think it's very hard to see any deal being done within the current transition period. I think it's highly likely that in order to get an agreed trade deal in place, we're going to need much more than 1 year to do so.
So the familiar words, an extension to our Brexit negotiations, probably going to be part of the lexicon for 2020 as well.
Yes. So the transition period ends in December 2020. But according to the withdrawal agreement, the UK and EU have to decide whether they want to extend it for up to 2 years by the 1st of July. So really the sort of key decision point is coming quite soon after the election. Markets aren't going to have much relief. They'll quickly focus on this 1st of July deadline, because as you know, we slip beyond that, then, you know, there really would be a risk of a no deal Brexit ever, you know, in December, because as I said, it's going to be very hard for all those details of a new trade deal to be thrashed out in the space of 12 months.
A no deal at Brexit occurring in that December, would that be the same as if we'd faced a no deal Brexit a few weeks ago, or do you think the period of time elapsing between then has reduced the potential damage?
Well, it really depends upon whether there's a blocking majority of MPs still left in the Commons that are prepared to, you know, vote down a no deal Brexit option. We know that a lot of the Remainers within the Conservative Party, you know, prominent Remainers, are standing down at this election or are being purged. So the, you know, a Conservative minority or a small majority could look very different after this general election to what it looked like 6 months ago.
Yeah.
You know, the Conservatives are going to be more sort of gung ho on Brexit, you know, if they do get a majority, and
yeah.
So it really will again depend upon whether there is still a cross party coalition of MPs still left to block a move to a no deal Brexit at that point. I think that could well be in doubt.
Okay, well, Sam, that's been really, really useful, really helpful to understand what's still quite a few moving parts that will determine how the UK economy performs for next year. And for a considerable period beyond, it is being billed as one of the most important elections the UK has faced in the post-war period. Would you agree with that?
It seems that way, but I reckon you could make that case after most elections. People always like to say that.
There we go. So a note of sobriety there to finish the podcast with. Sam, thanks so much for joining us. And thanks to all of our listeners as well. Hopefully you found that really interesting and helpful. And we look forward to joining you again for the next Brewin podcast. Thank you.